Good day. This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, January 27th, 2014. I'm Christina Thomas. Ozarks at Large is sponsored in part by the University of Arkansas Women's Giving Circle, whose mission is to transform and expand women's giving to university programs and research through a collective voice. Ahead, two University of Arkansas graduates take us back to the 1927 Mississippi River flood in their novel, Tilted World. And Benton County residents look to a vote to determine who should pay for rural ambulance services. Plus our weekly installment of Arkansongs and more. But first, 25 Arkansans have died from conditions associated with this year's strain of flu. Dr. Dirk Haslow with the Arkansas Department of Health says the number could grow to as high as 50. He says this year's flu virus is affecting a generally younger population than usual.
We want people in the age group between 25 and 50 to understand that, even though historically they have not been the targeted group for flu vaccination, that this year they are. There's something different about this strain that targets the younger groups, and it'd be a great idea to get your shot.
Dr. Haslow spoke to state lawmakers Friday about this year's flu situation. He says state health officials are monitoring a new, more aggressive policy of vaccinations being implemented in New York to see if it could benefit Arkansas in future flu seasons. The Internal Revenue Service is preparing for tax filing season. It's set to begin this Friday, January 31st. The agency advises those filing a tax return to find out about possible new deductions, how to determine filing status, and what tax credits are available. Lee Kreuzberg is a spokeswoman for the IRS. She encourages Arkansans to file electronically with a service known as e-file. She also says taxpayers will be able to monitor the status of their refunds online.
We're expecting 1.3 million tax returns to be filed in Arkansas this year. And certainly, we encourage people to e-file, and if they have a refund coming to them, opt for direct deposit. We expect to issue more than 90% of refunds in fewer than 21 days this year.
She encourages Arkansas residents who make less than $58,000 annually to visit the IRS website to look into how they can file taxes for free. But she warns people of potential email scams.
Obviously, the IRS does not initiate contact with taxpayers by email. We're never going to ask you, for your personal information, financial information, passwords, and we're also not going to do that via social media channels. So if you do get an email that looks like or appears to be from the IRS, don't reply to it. Don't open the attachment.
Kreuzberg says the federal government shutdown in October forced delays in implementing new systems, causing the tax filing season to start later this year. Drivers who use Highway 16 on their daily commute will likely be following detours starting today. The eastbound lane of Huntsville Road will be closed from 7 a.m. through 3 p.m. during weekdays beginning today. The closure extends between Morningside Drive and Curtis Avenue. The lane is closed so that improvements, including new sidewalks, bike lanes, new curb and gutter, and storm drain upgrades can be constructed. The improvements are being paid for through the city's capital improvement program, which is funded by city sales tax revenue. And the new sidewalk will complete the sidewalk connection from Morningside Drive to Happy Hollow Road. Sam's Club has announced a reduction in its middle management staff across the company. According to the City Wire, the warehouse retailer announced Friday that it would lay off 2,300 workers, representing roughly 2% of the company's workforce and its largest staff reduction since 2010. The layoffs will reportedly target a combination of salaried assistant managers and hourly employees, and certain positions, such as telephone attendants, will be eliminated. Sam's Club employs about 116,000 people. Company officials say the job cuts will affect about 4 employees per store. The Razorback women's basketball team had a rough night last night on the road. Arkansas led Kentucky at the end of the first half, but by the end of the game, Kentucky came out on top with a final score of 68-58. The loss puts Arkansas at 2 wins, 5 losses in SEC play, and at 15-5 on the season. Arkansas returns to the road Thursday evening when the team travels to Knoxville to play Tennessee. The Arkansas Forestry Commission continues encouraging people to avoid outdoor burning.
Anytime humidity is below 40%, it's a wildfire concern. But in comparison to last weekend, we had it down in the teens. So it is an improvement, but it's by far not optimal conditions.
As of this morning, burn bans were in place for 49 counties, and the risk of wildfires has been elevated to high for the entire state. Adrienne Barnes, spokeswoman for the commission, says conditions are ripe for fires to quickly spread. Several wildfires around the state have kept crews busy, including one Friday near Fordyce that burned 210 acres. Forecast this evening calls for cloudy skies with overnight lows from 4 degrees in northwest Arkansas to a low of 15 in the Arkansas River Valley. Mostly cloudy tomorrow with a high of 24 and a wind chill as low as minus 4 in northwest Arkansas. A high of 30 and a wind chill of 3 degrees in the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow evening, mostly clear with a low around 6, 13 in the Arkansas River Valley. This is Ozarks at Large. There has been strong debate recently over Emergency Medical Services, or EMS, in Benton County. City officials in Siloam Springs say if voters reject a proposal to charge an annual fee of $85, that city will stop providing service to unincorporated areas for the first time in 4 decades. Greg Neely, the city's fire chief, says a state law requires fiscal cooperation if a city is going to use a service beyond its boundaries. I spoke with Neely last week. He says the obligation rests with the county.
At this time, we finally drawn a line in the sand and said we need to be remunerated for actual expenses. To the county's credit, beginning in 2011, they began to pay us a little bit of money, like $20,000 the first year, about the same the next year, and this last payment was $52,000 for 2013.
So they're trying.
They have been, and so we have applauded their efforts for 2014, whereby we showed them actual expenses, had numerous forums that talked about what it actually cost us to respond. We agreed to a lesser amount than what was our actual expense because it was a significant increase over what we had been getting. But that amount was $335,000 that we were to be paid for providing that service in 2014. And part of that agreement, we told them, we charged them with, if you want us to continue to do this, then you need to provide a formula, an equitable formula, so that's data-driven, that ensures that these providers, Silent Springs included, are given an equitable share of that funding that is commensurate with what level of service and where out in the county we're providing, because there's a number of things that drive that. The population served, the distance that you have to travel, the condition of the roads, the ratio between the responses and the number of transports. And in every one of those categories, Silent Springs is number one or number two. And so it's very expensive for us to provide EMS out into the county. Having said that, they were supposed to come up with that mechanism beyond 2014, which was the referendum and the $85 per household. And somewhere along the way, unbeknownst to us, they determined that they were only going to provide the funding in 2014 for the first quarter, and then based upon the outcome of the that February 11th election, then they would determine whether or not they were going to continue to fund it beyond March.
Right, that's soon.
And that revelation is what shocked us.
And that goes up to a vote February 11th.
That's correct, February 11th.
Yeah. Just curious, you know, how many people will be losing the service that Siloam Springs provides.
Well,
if
you know, well, here's what we can do. We do know. Here we know the county was agreeing to pay us $324,000 in 2015. That was the previous agreement, and that was based upon an $85 per household fee. So, with some assumptions, 320 4,000 divided by the 85 per capita, that would get you nearly 4,000 households. That's 3,811. Now, there may have been some cushion in there.
Have you heard reaction from those households?
Yes, we have. You know, we see it in a number of forums. You know, we attended a county forum at the community center on the 20th, and also, you know, we look at the Facebook as well, you know, at the social media to see, and the reactions can be, you know, pretty severe. There's a lot of people that really are afraid that, you know, when they call 911, that service will not be available to them. Oftentimes, they are upset with the city, that the city would consider not providing that service. And yet, it is clearly the county's responsibility to provide that. And what I've often told people is, if you live out in the county, you don't expect to get a Silent Springs police officer there. You'll get someone from the county. If you have a big pothole in your county road, you don't look for the city street crew to come fix that. You look to the county. And yet, somehow in this discussion, we look to the city for the ambulance service, because we've been providing it, but at the same time, it is the county's responsibility to do that. And we just got to, at some point, say, county, do what you said you'd do and pay for the service. We're glad to provide it. You're talking about 400 calls a year that we respond out in the county. We're able to absorb that and continue to provide a high level of service for our folks on the interior, and we're willing to do that, but we just can't continue to do it for free.
I can't imagine calling 911 and my husband's having a heart attack and them just say, I'm sorry, we can't send somebody.
I mean, if there is no service provided, that would be the case. That would be the case. And nobody wants to see that.
Right.
We have been placed in that situation before when we were providing EMS well into Delaware County. And
that's in Oklahoma.
In Oklahoma. And so we advised them for a couple of years that this is the date in which it will stop. You need to get a service in here to provide it. And there did come that day when we said that we would no longer do that. And as a result of that, there were those types of calls and responses and concerns. It's very difficult. Nobody wants to not help somebody. That's what we do. But at the same time, you know, where do you draw the line? Our obligation here is to protect the citizens of Siloam, and that's our first obligation.
So this fails to pass on February 11th, and households are required to pay $85 if they want this service. Is the county sending a bill for $85 to these households? Do you have any idea how this will work?
I'm not sure how that mechanism is in place for that collection, but it will be up to the county to collect the $85, and then it will be up to the county to be able to distribute that to the 7 EMS providers based upon the per capita that each jurisdiction is serving.
The $85 is probably just based on what the municipalities tell the county, you know, this costs them.
Yeah, the way that $85 was arrived at, the way I understand it is, there was approximately, I'll just use the figure, $1 million, because that's approximately what it costs and what the 7 service providers have said they're going to need to be able to continue to provide it. And so the county utilized a formula that I'm sure has got some assumptions and some cushion to say that $85 is sufficient to be able to fund the 7 providers and allow a little bit for, you know, some inflation and cost adjustments and that sort of thing.
And $85 for the household, that doesn't cover any sort of ambulance fees or anything like that. That's just saying you'll come out to my house.
That's correct. The $85 will ensure when you call 911, you will get a response.
Right.
That keeps the service available. Yeah, we'll continue to bill for the insurance, Medicare, Medicaid.
As you have had interaction with both county officials and the citizens of the county and Siloam Springs, what do you think will happen on February 11th?
Well, there's still some time, and if the election were held today, I'd say it would be very close. But my hope is, as we draw closer to February 11th, the word will get out that this is a very reasonable request. You know, you're talking about $7 a month, $1.60 a day, to be able to provide a high quality service out into the county, and it will be a seamless transition. It will continue to be what it's always been. It's just that now the county will be assuming, as it should, its fiduciary responsibility to fund the providers to provide the service.
Well, thank you so much for your time, Mr. Neely. I don't believe I have any other questions.
Well, very good. No, appreciate the opportunity, and thank you for helping us get the word out.
Yep. That was Siloam Springs Fire Chief Greg Neely. Remaining town hall meetings on ambulance services to rural Benton County are scheduled for tomorrow evening at 6 p.m. in the Community Services Room at the Pea Ridge Fire Department, January 30th at 6:30 at the Centerton Fire Department, and at the Prairie Creek Association office, February 3rd at 7. This issue goes before voters February 11th.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, the poetry of the range from the 30th National Cowboy Poetry Gathering.
In this dark soil, I found reminders saying, you too will pass. Savor for us the wind and the sun.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Listen to Here and Now this afternoon from 1 to 3 on 91.3 FM.
5 years after the Great Recession, the economy is still on the mend. Plus, Walmart announces a new fund to create jobs and innovation in American manufacturing. Roby Brock has more in this Talk Business Arkansas update.
5 years since the Great Recession, more Arkansans feel the state is heading in the right direction than the wrong direction, and a majority identify the economy and jobs as their top issues of concern. In a new survey conducted on January 19th by Talk Business and Hendricks College, 520 likely Arkansas voters weighed in on the economy. About 55% said the economy and jobs were the most important issue facing Arkansas, with health care at 16% and education at 14% being distant alternative choices. Also, 48% said the state was heading in the right direction versus 36% who said the state was moving in the wrong direction. Walmart's U.S. President and CEO Bill Simon announced a new $10 million fund that the retail giant plans to make available for grants to manufacturing innovators. Speaking to the nation's mayors in Washington, D.C., Simon said the new fund would seek to create new processes, ideas, and jobs to support America's manufacturing footprint. Walmart's been touting efforts to draw overseas manufacturing jobs back to the U.S. Adding to its prepared foods arsenal, Tyson Foods announced that it will acquire Bosco's Pizza Company of Warren, Michigan for an undisclosed sum. Bosco's Pizza produces a variety of stuffed breadsticks and frozen pizzas for food service and retail customers throughout the Midwest and at some retailers nationwide. Tyson will continue to operate the products under the Bosco's Pizza name. J.B. Hunt announced record fourth quarter net earnings of $92 million on revenue of $1.47 billion, both of those up over last year's fourth quarter figures. For the full year, J.B. Hunt posted net income of $342 million on revenue of more than $5.5 billion. Simmons First National Corporation's $53.6 million buyout of Little Rock-based Metropolitan National Bank took a toll on fourth quarter and year-to-date net income. The Pine Bluff-based bank holding company reported fourth quarter net income of $3.8 million. That was down from $8 million in the previous year's fourth quarter. For the full year, Simmons First reported net income of $23.2 million compared to $27.6 million 1 year ago. The state of Arkansas will receive $459,000 in clawback funding from the tech giant Hewlett-Packard for its failure to meet employment goals as part of a $10 million incentive package. HP announced in December 2008 it would locate a tech support facility in Conway. It received roughly $10 million in incentives from Governor Mike Beebe's Quick Action Closing Fund as part of an agreement to create 1,000 jobs within 5 years. In mid-2013, HP laid off about 500 workers and later in the year announced it would hire 200 with different skill sets. As a result of the net employment figures, HP failed to meet all of the requirements of its original deal. I'm Roby Brock, and that is your Talk Business Arkansas update.
Support for Talk Business Arkansas on Ozarks at Large comes from AT&T, challenging drivers to take the pledge to never text and drive. No text is worth the risk. More information at itcanwait.com. This is Ozarks at Large. When the Mississippi River flooded in 1927, it created one of the worst natural disasters in American history. Tom Franklin and Beth Ann Finley used the flood as a backdrop for their novel, Tilted World. Tom's past novels, like Crooked Letter, Crooked Letter, have achieved critical praise, including the Los Angeles Times Book Award. Beth's poetry has been published widely, including in 3 editions of the Best American Poetry. Both teach at the University of Mississippi, where Beth is the director of the university's MFA program. Both also receive their MFAs at the University of Arkansas. Tilted World takes readers inside a different era, when Prohibition was a boon to bootleggers, and people in rural Mississippi were just as likely to travel by foot or horse as car. Beth Ann Finley and Tom Franklin will read from their novel and sign copies at Nightbird Books in Fayetteville Friday night at 6:30. This month, Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums reached them at their home in Oxford, Mississippi. Beth told Kyle that even though the flood of 1927 was devastating and changed the course of history, many people don't know about it.
Yeah, absolutely, Kyle. In fact, I had never heard of the flood till I moved to the South for the first time. I grew up in a suburb outside of Chicago. And when I moved to the South and learned about the flood, I was stunned that I had never heard about it before because the destruction was so unbelievable. 1 million people lost their houses. When the levee broke in outside of Greenville, Mississippi, and the water came through, it came through with twice the force of Niagara, and a wall of water 100 feet high scooped out the delta, yet I'd simply never heard of it. Probably there were several reasons. Most of the people affected were poor Southerners, both white and black, and also, it was in the politicians' best interest to kind of minimize and downplay the story of the flood devastation. So reading about the flood was really eye-opening for us.
And then to have the context, of course, of Prohibition and bootlegging, how much research did you have to do to make sure you got things right?
Well, Bethany, I did a lot of research, the truth. She's the one who enjoys research in our duo, and I'm not. So she did a lot of great research on the flood, and as well as Prohibition, World War One, all kinds of things. I'll let you talk there, Beth Ann. Go ahead.
Sure. Well, in truth, Kyle, the research was really fun because it's this great unimagined American story. It's not a story that has been told ad nauseum. So we did a whole bunch of different kinds of research. Reading the history books, of course, was great, and there's a famous and really useful and well-written book by John M. Barry called Rising Tide. It's a great nonfiction account of the flood. And reading the books by historians was really useful, but what was also really cool was when Tommy and I would drive down and research. We went to the place where the levee broke. We went to the Flood Museum in Greenville, and we did a lot of archival research, too. In particular, I got interested in letters and journals that women actually were keeping at the time, describing to their sister what they'd seen, because to read the statistic that 330,000 people were rescued from rooftops and barns is, of course, stunning, but it's so abstract, it's almost hard to get your head around. Meanwhile, we want to show the reader one person being rescued. So to have those women writing in their dialect and the time period from 1927 and describing what they saw was really useful, and the research was fascinating, but that, of course, was the danger. The research was so fascinating that there came a point where we just had to stop because doing more research wouldn't help us get the book written. Doing more research was another word for procrastination.
Well, I think of the quote attributed to Alfred Hitchcock when he says that it's far more interesting to know that there is a bomb under the table that might go off rather than just having this second where a bomb goes off. And that's kind of what we have in this book. If you know about the flood, you know it's coming, and so you tease us. And there's this sort of tension that grows as you go further in.
Well, good. If that happened, that's great, because that was one of the things we were going for.
Yeah, the flood's a good natural climactic event. And, you know, it did seem a good spot to aim for. You know, we all didn't always know what was going to happen, but we knew that flood was coming. And, we just would have to see how our people would respond to it when it did happen, finally.
I have to ask about how it worked, the physical work of writing a novel together. Tommy, you've written novels. Beth Ann, you're known for poetry. Did you submit to each other and revise? Did you write at the same time? And then, okay, an hour from now, we'll look at what each other has written?
Well, there are two main characters, Dixie Clay and Ingersoll, man and woman. The original idea was for me to write Ingersoll, the man, and Beth Ann to write Dixie Clay, the woman. And that's how we started. And it would have been a good idea, except Beth Ann, the A student, finished her half before I, the B student, had even begun my half. So we just, we were on different tracks a little bit. So, when she had her half done, and she then began to wait for me to do my half, and of course I don't respond well to people waiting on me. And so we then talked and decided to work on my half together. So we wrote my half in Beth Ann's tiny office in the back of our house with our knees touching and just with both of our laptops back there. She called it dueling laptops. And that worked really well, and then the writing became far more interesting for both of us, in that before it had just been writing the way writing always had been, one person alone at his or her computer. But now it was two people in a room talking about what we were doing, and even writing sentences together, finishing one another's sentences as we worked. So that's when it really became, a much truer collaboration than it had been at first.
Can you, when you go back and read this, can you see each other's voices in it? Because I had no idea that might be a Franklin sentence or that might be a Fenley sentence.
Well, the truth is most of them are Fenley sentences. I mean, she wrote about 75% of the book if we do the math. So I think that's part of it. But part of it, is an answer Beth Ann gave that I really liked to a question similar a few months ago. And it was this, that we have been reading each other's stuff for almost 20 years now. We've been each other's first best reader for, half Beth Ann's life and, a good part of my life. So in a way, we've been collaborating for years, and every novel that I've written, Beth Ann has been intricate to that novel. She would have read it in very early drafts. She would have talked about the ideas with me. She would have edited it extensively and, again, just talked more and listened and asked questions. She's literally the best editor I've ever worked with, and I've had now, a number of editors. So, I've really benefited from that, I think, with every book. And so coming to this new one, where we're working on it together, it just seemed like a natural step in the evolution, of us as writers.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I do think it's a compliment when our friends who have read both of our separate writings say, "Oh, I was reading your novel, and I was looking for the seams and trying to listen for the voice change when one of you stopped writing, the other started, and I couldn't find the seams." And I do really think that that's a lovely thing to say. And in a way, it's surprising, but in a way, it's not, because we did meet 19 years ago there in Kimball Hall at the University of Arkansas, where we'd both come to study writing. And from that day to today, there's hardly a day gone by where we haven't either been exchanging our own words or talking about books we love or, talking about student work together that we've both been reading, and always this idea of maybe our voices growing closer, or at least understanding each other's voices, led to this moment that we didn't even know we were preparing for.
Were there conversations, sort of analytical conversations, about how to set a scene? The book opens with this wonderfully cinematic scene when this orphaned child is found by these agents, and we go from there. I mean, would you talk about certain words or turns of phrases, or did it just flow?
Well, all of it. I mean, sometimes it didn't just flow, you know. Sometimes it was agony, and sometimes it came pretty easily, and sometimes we would just get to a little hitch, and we wouldn't know what would happen next, and it was really frustrating. We'd have to talk our way through it, maybe try a couple wrong moves, and then steer ourselves over to the right one somehow. And, you know, now that it's done, we look back, and it all seems so foreordained and destined. But
yeah.
There were lots of really confusing moments during the whole time. We just tend to forget about them now because they were so painful.
But what's also interesting is that, you know, those confusing moments were less irksome because there were two of us to work them out, as opposed to there just being one person to work them out. You know, if it had been me alone or Beth Ann alone, you know, and we might have helped each other, but the help could only be go to a certain extent. You know, this help went far deeper in than it otherwise would have, because we're, you know, because it's the same project, we have the same goal in mind.
It feels, when I read it, of course, it's something that happened more than 80 years ago, and it does feel as if it's a completely different world. Of course, I didn't grow up in Mississippi. Am I right in feeling that there's this otherworldliness about what's happening around the town of Hobnob, Mississippi, in the Tilted World?
Yeah, I think so. You know, 1927 was such a fascinating year, and we really wanted to do justice to the fact that it was a year in which the world changed, and I mean that quite literally. At the end of the year, one out of five people in America had a car. That was the year people got electricity. That was the year, because people got cars, hotels started being built, which meant people started having sex outside of marriage, and so condom sales started increasing, and the per capita income of Americans went up, and it was the year where women started showing their knees, for example. I mean, just think about a year in which women show their knees for the first time and how that's going to change American culture. So we really wanted to, you know, create this world where all the old way was making a big turn, and to put into this prohibition, which was really interesting for the kind of extreme behaviors it elicited, it just seemed like a really ripe place to set a novel, and the flood, of course, the natural climax.
Dixie is a wonderful character, and the fact that you mentioned prohibition, she's such a good bootlegger and smarter than just about, or is smarter, really, than anybody else about her. I can imagine she was a fun, interesting character to develop.
Yeah, she was. We had a lot of fun with her. And, you know, in order to do research about how she was such a good bootlegger, of course, Tommy and I were forced to taste a glass or two during the writing of the novel.
A glass or two of you know, stuff created by, say, non-professionals?
Yes. But you didn't hear that from us.
Okay.
Right.
And how is it?
Delicious.
Well, some of it is not so good, but we actually did find some that is pretty delicious. We found a guy who makes apple pie moonshine, and we ended up having him make a batch for our book release party.
Tom, I want to ask you about writing dialogue, because in Crooked Letter, it was great. In this book, it's fantastic. I think that writing dialogue has to be one of the most difficult things, because you want to get it right. You want to set it in a period. You want to set it in a place so it sounds genuine, but you don't want to go too far. How do you know when you've got just the right dialogue going?
Well, you know, for me, it's just a matter of feel. It's a matter of using dialect a lot less than more. You know, a little bit of dialect goes a long way. So I try not to use that a lot. And hopefully just the rhythms of, you know, of the character's speech will come through. And, you know, and one thing that helps it are the expressions that people use in the country. Those are always fun. And people do use those. So, you know, we try to put a few of those in here and there. And really, it's just simply a matter of making each character sound a little bit different from the other. So with Crooked Letter, I'm working with, you know, the African-American dialect and, you know, and even a Chicago accent at one point. And then just, you know, the regular white guy's dialect and the white women's dialect. Simply a matter of, you know, for me, it's been a lifetime of listening. I grew up in Alabama and grew up listening to the difference between white people and black people, the way they talk, and there are differences. And there are differences, of course, between the way Alabamians and Arkansans talk. So just trying to get all those little, just try to get it all right. I remember listening to William Gay talk once, and he mentioned, you know, a chap. And in Tennessee, they call, you know, young toddlers chaps, which I'd never heard. So that will be true to that area. So, you know, just trying to be true to whatever area that we're writing about.
I have to admit, I had never heard or read the word diddy referring to a diaper.
Yeah, I think actually it was pronounced Didi.
Didi. Ah, that makes sense.
Yeah, but it was a country word in the south part of Mississippi. And you know, we learned a couple, like I said, just from reading those initial texts, but things like William Anderson Percy's discussion of living in Greenville during the flood, but that, for example, that they called a front porch a gallery, you know, was new to us as well, but it was so uniform and such a commonly used word at the time that we decided to use it and just assume that the reader could figure out what we were talking about.
And there's another example that I like that Beth Ann found. I was reading a chapter she had written, and Ham Johnson was talking about handcuffs, and he called them bracelets. I thought, that's great. And she's read that somewhere, that someone referred to handcuffs as bracelets. So, you know, so all that kind of research really does pay off, you know, and those little words find their way in. And each example of that bolsters the novel in a tiny way, which, you know, works, you know, when they all add up, it hopefully works well.
Finally, did your experience as parents help you, because you're writing about this very young human being who is found early and part of the story, and making sure the junior is fed and his diaries are taken care of? Did you flash back to some of your parenting?
Well, we ended up doing a little bit more than flashing back. Say, during the course of the novel, you know, this novel took us almost 4 years to write, which when you think that there were two of us, that's like 8 years, that's pretty pathetic. But in addition to having to figure out how to collaborate, which was a new thing, we were slowed down by this one little hiccup, which is to say, we took this very romantic anniversary trip to the south of France, and you know, we drank all this wine, it was so beautiful, and we came home, and I had... you know, some type of crazy bug. I've had food poisoning. It wouldn't go away. It wouldn't go away. It wouldn't go away. Turns out it was a baby. So our children are now 12, 8, and 2. And that 2-year-old, you know, came along and really, as you can imagine, ended up changing things a bit in our little household. But I would say, you know, there were so many unexpected pleasures about this unexpected child. And even in writing the novel, there was this giant joy in being a mom and being able to look at my baby and have that be part of my work in a way. There's always this terrible feeling you have to turn your gaze away, rip your gaze away really, to focus on your work. And here was a time when Dixie Clay, you know, had a baby and I was playing with my baby, and I decided at one point to freeze the baby in the novel, Willie, at 7 months, because my baby was 7 months, and just describe everything about him. And you know, it was so fun to be able to bring him into our novel in that way.
Tom Franklin and Beth Ann Finley are the authors of the novel Tilted World and teach at the University of Mississippi. They'll read from and sign copies of their book Friday night at 6:30 at Nightbird Books on Dixon Street in Fayetteville. They spoke with Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums earlier this month.
When there's a big story, there's a rush to connect the dots. But if you do that too soon, the dots sometimes don't tell the right story. At Morning Edition, we're taking time to get the facts, to paint a bigger picture. No hysteria, no hype, just the whole story. Listen each weekday as we collect the dots, and let's find out what they mean together here on Morning Edition.
Morning Edition, tomorrow morning from 5 to 9, here on your source for NPR programming, KUAF 91.3 FM.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkan Songs. Bobby Whitlock was born March 18, 1948, in Memphis, Tennessee. The family moved to Marmaduke in Greene County, Arkansas, and later moved to Diaz in Jackson County when Whitlock was 9. Bobby and his mother worked in the cotton fields around Diaz, Newport, Lepanto, and beyond. Always into music, he played guitar, piano, and sang. A fixture on the Memphis music scene following high school, Bobby Whitlock signed to Stax Records' Hip subsidiary.
There's a thorn tree in the garden, if you know just what I mean. And I hate to hurt your feelings, but it's not the way it seems, 'cause I miss her.
Bobby Whitlock met Delaney and Bonnie Branlett, a musical couple also signed to Stax, while playing at their sessions. They'd recorded an album called Home, but had left the deal to go to Los Angeles, California, and sign with Elektra Records, and convinced Whitlock to join them. He played organ and piano and sang on Delaney and Bonnie's album Accept No Substitute, along with Leon Russell, Carl Radle, and others. When Accept No Substitute was released to acclaim, Stax released their own Delaney and Bonnie album, Home. In late 1969, Delaney and Bonnie and friends got the opening slot, touring with the first rock supergroup, Blind Faith, with Eric Clapton, Stevie Winwood, Rick Gretsch, and Ginger Baker. That's where Bobby Whitlock met Eric Clapton. But Eric Clapton had tired of the limelight, and he admired the give and take amongst the players in Delaney and Bonnie and Friends. After the Blind Faith tour, Clapton joined Delaney and Bonnie Bramlett and the Friends. But though Clapton made the move to avoid the direct spotlight, English promoters couldn't resist featuring the Clapton name. Amidst the chaos of being on tour with the embattled Bramletts, Bobby Whitlock and Eric Clapton honed their sound together. Bobby Whitlock and Eric Clapton enlisted bassist Carl Radle and drummer Jim Gordon as the rhythm section and called themselves Derek and the Dominoes, a play on Clapton's nickname of Derek. Dwayne Allman also played. The resulting album, Layla and Other Assorted Love Songs, the band's only studio album, is considered a rock classic beyond the ubiquitous title track. Another Arkansas connection, Clapton said an Albert King lick inspired the memorable Layla opening riff. Equally memorable was the way Whitlock and Clapton's voices meshed through such songs as Bell Bottom Blues and the title track Layla. The group played the Johnny Cash Show when the album was released in November 1970.
Outside the wind blows and whispers the sound of your name. Yesterday's over, tomorrow is still more of the same.
Whitlock, Clapton, and the other Dominoes had previously joined Billy Preston, Ringo Starr, Gary Wright, and a host of other musicians contributing to George Harrison's All Things Must Pass triple album produced by Phil Spector. Like the Layla album, All Things Must Pass was released in November 1970. Whitlock also played uncredited on the Rolling Stones' 1972 double LP, Exile on Main Street. In the mid-1980s, Bobby Whitlock landed some songs on other performers' records like John Prine, George Jones, Tom Jones, and Michael Nesmith, including Slip Away on the 1985 Ray Charles album From the Pages of My Mind. Through the 1970s, Bobby Whitlock also offered up his own handful of solo albums, but it's no surprise that Whitlock remains known as the quintessential sideman. considering the certifiable rock and roll classics on which he sang, performed, or written, that's as it should be. Here in its entirety is Derek and the Dominoes featuring Bobby Whitlock of Diaz in Jackson County with Thorn Tree in the Garden from 1970's Layla and Other Assorted Love Songs.
There's a thorn tree in the garden, if you know just what I mean. And I hate to hurt your feelings, but it's not the way it seems, 'cause I miss her. She's the only girl I've cared for, the only one I've known, and no one ever shared more love. But it all seems so strange, you see, 'cause she'd never turn her back on me and leave without a last goodbye. And if she winds up walking the streets, loving every other man she meets, who'll be the one to answer why? Lord, I hope it's not me. If I never see her face again, I'll never hold her hand. And if she's in somebody's arms, I know I'll understand. But I miss that girl. I still miss that girl.
Thorn Tree in the Garden from the album Layla and Other Assorted Love Songs by Derek and the Dominoes, featuring Bobby Whitlock of Jackson County. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of KUAR and Experiment Station Studios. Associate producer is Keith Merks. For more information, go to arkansongs.org. Arkansongs, since 1998.
Tuesday night, an NPR News special, live coverage of President Obama's State of the Union address. I'm Robert Siegel. Join me for in-depth analysis and reaction from members of Congress. You'll also hear the Republicans' response to the president's speech, an NPR News special, President Obama's State of the Union address.
Listen tomorrow night beginning at 8 to KUAF 91.3 FM.
It is Monday, January 27th, 2014. This is Ozarks at Large, and joining me now is Becca Martin Brown, features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
I see hope.
Hope? I hope so.
That we might actually get through January.
Oh.
You know, Antoinette and I are always talking about time flies.
I know.
Keep on flying. It's cold.
Till spring. Yeah.
But while you're waiting, you need a good book, right?
Always.
And the University of Arkansas at Fort Smith is launching this year's Read This, which they've done, I believe, for 3 years now.
And this is the Everybody Read This One book.
Right.
Right.
And the author this year is Tim O'Brien, a Vietnam War veteran who wrote The Things They Carried.
Okay, that sounds familiar.
Won a Pulitzer Prize, mm-hmm. or was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. It's a retelling of his time in Vietnam. Came out about 1990. And on Tuesday at 2:30 is the book launch at UAFS in the Borum Library. On February 27th, there's a read aloud at the fireplace at the Smith Pendergraft Campus Center. On March 3rd, there's a film, Dear America, Letters Home from Vietnam. And on March 12th, Tim O'Brien will be speaking at the Stubblefield Center. I have a couple of reporters who are just beside themselves.
Dying to interview him.
Yes, this is not an author that I know about, but now I'm interested. So I may just wander across to the library later today and get my own copy of the book.
That's what I was going to say. I need to find my copy.
And you can find out more by email at Eric, E-R-I-K, dot Carlson at UAFS.edu.
All right. Thanks, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
American composer Paul Lansky says his piece Horizons was inspired by the wide range of expressive postures and textures that the ensemble of piano, cello, vibes, and percussion is capable of. Hi, I'm Katie Henriksen, host of Of Note, Monday through Friday from 11 to noon on KUAF. Join me for Paul Lansky's Horizons. That's Tuesday from 11 to noon right here on KUAF.
And this is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Combs. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Christina Thomas. Support for Ozarks at Large on KUAF comes from the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. Last night, music lovers tuned in to the 56th Annual Grammy Awards to watch many performances and some artists receive recognition for their work. The songs we heard in between stories today were just some of last night's winners, including Rihanna and Vampire Weekend. And speaking of music, George's Majestic Lounge on Dixon Street in Fayetteville announced today that Les Claypool will play at George's March 11th. Tickets go on sale this Friday. Les Claypool is best known for his work with the band Primus. So we end the show with his music. This is Vernon the Company Man. And as it turns out, my grandfather's name was Vernon. Thank you so much for listening and have a good Monday.
Vernon was a company man. He kept his hair trimmed short and his sideburns shaved. He's a Brill Cream man. He liked Swiss and ham. He drank beer out the can on Saturdays. He was a company man. Vernon was a company man. His hat glopped onto his head like a bottle cap. His face red like a topographical map. And he could chat like a bird when there was nothing to say. He's a company man. He's a company man.